used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals.
I mean, the less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to Animal Voices, Western Canada's only radio program dedicated to animal advocacy and compassionate living. This is 100.5 FM, Vancouver Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, unceded Coast Salish territories. Today is Friday, May 31st, 2019. I'm your host, Elise Jacobson, and I'm joined here in the studio today by my co-host and control room operator, Allison Cole.
Good afternoon.
Our feature interview today is with photographer Issa Leshko. Issa is an artist and writer whose work examines themes relating to animal rights, aging, and mortality. Her images have been published in media around the world, including The Atlantic, The Guardian, and The New York Times, among others. In April 2019, the University of Chicago Press published her first book entitled Allowed to Grow Old, Portraits of Elderly Rescued Farm Animals. The book includes essays by activist Jean Bauer, New York Times bestselling author Cy Montgomery, and curator Ann Wilkes Tucker. In this interview, Issa discusses the power of photography, the invisibility of farmed animals in our culture, and the importance of seeing them as sentient individuals, and the blessing of being allowed to grow old. That's coming up in just about 15 minutes, so stay tuned. And in a little bit, I'll also be discussing my recent trip to Italy and sharing my experience of being vegan while traveling there. But first, Allison has the news for us.
Yes, so there's a lot going on in this week's news, but our whole news segment is going to be dedicated to something that just came out last few days. It is a continuation to news that we've reported in the past. So it's just been over 1 month since we at Animal Voices, along with 200 local and other activists, took part in the first of its kind action in Canada called Meet the Victims. You remember it, 50 activists, including myself, took part in an occupation of a pig factory farm in Abbotsford, BC, the Excelsior Hog Farm, for over 6 hours on April the 28th, until our request was met that the mainstream media be allowed in to take a tour of the facility that was saturated with the smells, sights, and miserable living conditions of no less than a hell on earth. We will never forget that day, the victims who we left there to live a life of continuous suffering. And the next week, we presented a show all about Meet the Victims Canada, and you can find that posted on our website for the May 3rd post at animalvoices.org to learn more, to learn what the mainstream media won't tell you. Now, earlier in that week when the MTV Canada action occurred, graphic images of immense cruelty at this farm were anonymously submitted to the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, otherwise known as PETA, and PETA submitted them to CTV News. They were made public for everyone to see and included videos of dead, rotting pigs lying among the kept pigs, cannibalization, pigs with untreated hernias, lameness, and more. The SPCA said that these videos were grounds for an official investigation and said they would be investigating the farm for animal cruelty. When we occupied the farm 5 days later, dozens of us activists were conducting video live streams of the horrors that we were seeing. The same pigs living in filthy conditions, lying in their own urine and feces, unable to move or turn around in their narrow, confined stalls. The air so soaked with the dank stench of ammonia from their waste that it was so disgusting and would no doubt cause respiratory conditions to anyone living in that area. Pigs with gashes and sores on their bodies, and we even witnessed a mother pig having a miscarriage and convulsing for hours after with no treatment, even when the farm's veterinarian attended and said that there was nothing wrong happening at this place. These images that cannot be denied because they can't be denied because we captured them in photos and video that day when we were there at Meet the Victims on April the 28th. So now, Just 2 days ago, on May the 29th, the BCSPCA has announced that it is not recommending charges against the Excelsior Hog Farm, which holds a title of being a leading pig farm in BC in terms of having the best animal welfare, if you can imagine that. The SPCA Chief Enforcement Officer, Marcy Moriarty, said that without the cooperation of the person who recorded the video, there's little that investigators can do to build a case. Now, because the person who took the video has not come forward, she said that Crown Counsel would not approve charges without evidence backing up the video so that there would be no case to present. The farm has claimed that some of the video footage first presented may not have even been taken at the farm, whereas we had one of the anonymous activists on our show on May 3rd declare that all the videos were definitely taken at this farm. After visiting the farm itself, by which time the farm owners had had over a good week of notice that the SPCA would be stopping by for them to clean up all around, the SPCA found no evidence that the factory farm had violated either the Code of Practice for Handling Animals or BC's Prevention of Cruelty to Animals Act. So what do you think of this? Despite the incriminating evidence of absolute cruelty taking place at the farm from much of the video and photo documentation taken on April the 28th, Meet the Victims Action, the BCSPCA says there's no usable evidence. What are your thoughts on that, Elise?
That is shocking to me. I saw quite a bit of the photos and the footage myself, and yeah, definitely very chilling. As you were sort of recounting it, I kind of had a chill in my bones thinking about it. Yeah, it's incredible to me, not only that the farm would deny that this footage was taken there, but then, you know, that the charges won't be pressed.
And the farmers are also captured on camera saying things like, this has devastated us, we're just a hardworking family, we love what we do.
Wow.
It's a fun job, they said.
Oh, gosh.
And, you know, support these hardworking farmers is basically the message that is always coming along. But you know what? I was just listening to a podcast on the way here where this has been filmed for an upcoming documentary thing with Sean Monson and Kathy Freston. They did this recently. They went to see a farmer who I believe is a beef farmer, and they showed that he's transitioning to hemp farming.
Wow.
So it can be done.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So anyways, like I said, despite all the incriminating evidence of absolute cruelty taking place at the farm, there's so much there, right? The BCSPCA says there's still no usable evidence. In a video live stream on the Vancouver Humane Society's Facebook page this week, animal justice lawyer Anna Pippis reported that many of the conditions we witnessed are actually within the Code of Practice for Farmed Animal Welfare in BC. Canadian Farms Animal Welfare Protocol is self-regulated, so they really have no one to answer to. And it may be known that the owner of this particular farm is actually a director of the BC Pork Producers Association and well respected within the farming community. But the story doesn't end here. Stay tuned for more to come about the farm. And just to let you know, it's not over yet.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. And remember that, you know, if you don't want to support this kind of thing or contribute to it, the best thing you can do is just leave animals off your plate.
And I think a lot of people have been convinced to do that after a lot of this video footage has come out. And you can see it on our page as well, Animal Voices Vancouver.
So now I just wanted to share with you a trip that I just got back from. I just spent 2 weeks in Italy, traveling around Rome and Sicily. I just got back a couple of days ago. Just for a little background, I've been wanting to do this trip for years. It was a little bit of a pilgrimage for me. My great-grandparents were from a village in Sicily called Polizzi Generosa. And ever since I found out about that, I've wanted to go back and visit and find the home that my great-grandfather was born in and just sort of be there, go back to my roots a little bit. So yeah, I've been planning the trip for years and was super excited to finally get to do it just in the last couple of weeks. So I just wanted to share with our listeners sort of what my experience was like being vegan in Rome and Sicily.
I'm super interested in learning about that.
Oh, yeah, cool. I would say that if you plan to travel there, it helps a lot to at least learn a few basic words and phrases in Italian. I speak some Italian. I understand quite a bit, but it's something like my fifth language by now, so I don't speak it particularly fluently, but what little I spoke came in handy a lot. And failing that, you know, bring a phrase book or a good translation app that works too. So starting with Rome, we flew straight into Rome. I was there with my boyfriend, Victor. And I would say the highlights from Rome, it's a pretty vegan-friendly city overall. It's a major city. There's a lot of tourism there. And it's also in the south of Italy, so you can get, you know, southern Italian cuisine tends to be more plant-heavy than northern Italian cuisine, so it's pretty easy to find plant-based dishes there, traditional dishes. However, I would say probably the food highlight for me was a restaurant called Rifugio Romano, right in the heart of Rome. It's an amazing restaurant. It's not a vegan restaurant, but they have a very extensive vegan menu. Like, they have a separate vegan menu that's like 3 pages long.
That makes it a vegan restaurant in its own.
Yeah, pretty much. Like, it's that. Like two restaurants in one. And this menu includes everything from antipasti to primi piatti, the first courses, and secondi piatti, the second courses, and dessert. It's just like a ton of selection. You could eat there, you know, every day for a week and not get through everything. We actually ended up going back 3 times. The third time was kind of by accident, but it was fantastic. They have this sort of vegan charcuterie board that has like their house-made vegan cheeses and like sliced, you know, vegan meats. And I had this beautiful ravioli that had squash and sage, and Victor had a vegan pasta carbonara. Pasta carbonara is normally made with egg and bacon and stuff, but they made a vegan version of it, and it's incredible. You can get all these very traditional Italian dishes, but made vegan. And we also did a vegan food tour. They have a vegan food tour in Rome, which is super cool. We showed up and met the tour guide, and it turned out that we were the only people on the tour, so it was like a private
tour. Nice. Private tour. Can you tell me who puts on that tour? I'm not sure.
You know, I think the company is just called Vegan Food Tours. They have vegan
food tours. I'm going to look that up.
Yeah, do it. They're in several cities, like cities around Europe and various things. She took us to 3 different spots, and we tried out various local delicacies that were vegan, so that was super lovely. And she also kind of showed us some sites around the town, and we did a lot of sightseeing on our own too, but she kind of had some good insights being a local and, you know, spoke fluent English and everything, so that was great. And then from there we went to Palermo, Sicily. And there I tried a local Sicilian street food snack for the first time. It was called panelle. And panelle, I love. It's these little squares of like fried dough that's made of chickpea flour.
And yeah, I think I've seen that in one of my recipe books.
Right. Yeah, it's a very like standard Sicilian street food, and it's totally vegan. They often sprinkle a little fresh lemon juice over it and some black pepper, and it's super good. You can just buy it at all kinds of places around Sicily on the street. We also ate at a restaurant that was called Ethnic, and they kind of have a range of like, it's a vegetarian restaurant, and they do sort of dishes that are inspired by world cuisines and as well as Sicilian food, and that was really lovely. And we also went to, we did a little bit of grocery shopping to make some meals in our little apartments that we were staying at.
So what are the grocery shops like in Italy, like the supermarkets?
You know, surprisingly not bad. There's a grocery store that you can find around Europe called Lidl, L-I-D-L, and it's a discount grocery store, but they had a surprising number of vegan things that were super cheap. We found vegan croissants, vegan yogurt, veggie burgers.
And they were all different brands than what we have here?
Yeah, cool. Different brands, like European brands. Yeah, so that was super cool. We, you know, got stuff for breakfast and stuff to make a couple of dinners, and it was really, really cheap, so that was great. And then from there, we did a day trip to the village that I was talking about where my great-grandparents were from, Polizzi Generosa. It was about 1.5-hour bus ride away. Absolutely gorgeous place. I think there's minimal tourism there. Not many people know about it, but it's like nestled in this beautiful green valley, and it's absolutely incredible. It's a small town. There's only about 3,300 people who live there. But we found this place, a B&B called I Templari, and they have a little restaurant with the B&B, and they have a sign out front where they explicitly listed that they can make vegetarian and vegan dishes. I was absolutely shocked. It's a tiny town in the middle of nowhere. And it's owned by this lovely couple. The husband is Sicilian and the wife is Thai. And so they make Sicilian dishes and Thai dishes. And my boyfriend at that time was kind of craving Asian food, so we decided to get their pad thai and give it a try, and it was absolutely lovely. They were super friendly, and we sat outside, and there were like wild tortoises in the grass. Wow. And like, yeah, and birds and stuff, and yeah, it was gorgeous. And we also later for dinner, we had a little dinner at another restaurant called Ubagyu, which is just a very, you know, traditional Sicilian family restaurant. Not a ton of vegan stuff on the menu from what I could tell, but we ordered a pasta pomodoro, which is like just pasta with tomatoes or tomato sauce. Very simple, but it was really good. And from there we went to Catania, which is another like larger city in Sicily. And that was the first time that we tried granita, which is also a traditional Sicilian sort of dessert or snack. It's kind of a crushed ice dessert. The texture is somewhere between shaved ice and sorbet. It's kind of like smoother than shaved ice, but a little grainier than sorbet, but very light and refreshing. We had a lemon granita. Actually, pretty much the entire reason I scheduled Catania into the trip was because of this place called Bar Dolcezza. And this place also is not fully vegan, but they have a very extensive vegan menu, and they have an entire pastry case of vegan pastries. All the pastries they make
well,
are vegan.
Well, of course you would go there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, yeah, I'm a bit of a sweet
tooth. Isn't this an interesting concept where these places in Europe are not vegan, but they have a lot of vegan options, so they might as well be a vegan restaurant.
I know. I don't really understand why they don't. But yeah, anyway, we had a wonderful lunch there. And we also tried cannoli, tiramisu, which was out of this world, and something that they called American cake, which I found very amusing.
was it like a chocolate cake?
Yeah, it was kind of chocolate with like Bavarian cream and this frosting on the top, and then it had little strawberries. But everything was absolutely amazing. And yeah, all of the pastries they make are vegan, and they have a lot of vegan items for lunch, so that was super great. And then before we run out of time, I wanted to talk about Siracusa, which was pretty much the last stop on our trip. And this place is incredible. It's also kind of a smaller town in Sicily, more to the southeast, but it is super vegan friendly. It's small, so it's easy to walk around, and you can just like get to vegan friendly restaurants wherever you are, and it's like picturesque, absolutely amazing. We ate at a restaurant called Just Veggie for lunch a couple of times. That's an all vegan restaurant there. I had a pesto gnocchi that was great. Victor had a pasta with porcini mushrooms that he absolutely loved. And for dinner, we went to a restaurant called Moon, which is a little bit like fancier, I guess, and it's an all-vegan restaurant, but they also do things like pasta carbonara and tiramisu and, you know, twists on Sicilian food that are vegan and just absolutely beautiful. We tried a very hyper-local wine there called Nero d'Avola, which I think you can get here. It's from the town of Avola in Sicily. A beautiful red wine. We also had vegan pizzas at a place called La Pecora Nera, the Black Sheep. And they had, yeah, this wasn't a vegan place, but they had like a separate vegan pizza menu, and they were great.
Did they have vegan cheese?
Yeah, they actually impressive. Did. Yeah, it was great. It was great, and seitan and stuff like that. I wanted to mention too that Sicily is a citrus lover's paradise. If you love citrus fruits, you have to go there if you can. There's lemons and oranges growing everywhere. If you travel sort of through the countryside, you see these massive orchards of lemon trees and orange trees. It's beautiful. The farmer's market in Siracusa like happens every single day, and we bought some beautiful blood oranges there, which we had a few times around the trip in Sicily, and they were the best oranges we'd ever had. They were absolutely beautiful. We also tried a street food snack called arancini, which you can get vegan versions of. Super good.
It's I know what that is.
Yeah, a little fried risotto ball, right?
With cheese in it?
Sometimes it has cheese in it. Yeah.
Sauce or something. Yeah.
Yeah, but they do different versions. We had some great ones, and even had like vegan gelato in Siracusa. There's a place that, you know, does like a soy-based vegan gelato that was delicious. So anyway, that's all the time we have for that. But I just wanted to share all that with you. It is absolutely possible to be vegan while you're traveling and have an excellent time.
And particularly in Italy, it sounds like.
Yes,
lots of great food. That's great to know.
Throughout our lives, we're presented with images of happy animals on farms. Ironically, most often in advertisements for products that rely on killing these animals at a fraction of their natural lifespan. How many of us consider that when we consume animal products, we're actually eating babies? A pig can enjoy life for 12 years, but those who wind up on people's plates aren't typically allowed to live longer than 6 months. Chickens can live 8 years, but those who get eaten are only allowed around 7 weeks of life. A cow can live up to 20 years, but on dairy farms, they don't make it past the age of 4, and for beef cattle, only a year and a half. So what is lost when we consume animal products? We're about to explore that in our feature interview with photographer Iza Leshko. Iza is an artist and writer whose work examines themes relating to animal rights, aging, and mortality. Her new book, entitled Allowed to Grow Old, Portraits of Elderly Rescued Farm Animals, has received critical acclaim from The New York Times, The Guardian, The Atlantic, among several other publications. She joins us to discuss the power of photography, the invisibility of farmed animals in our culture, the importance of seeing them as sentient individuals, and the blessing of being allowed to grow old. Hello, Iza, and welcome to Animal Voices.
Hi, I'm happy to be here. Thanks.
So, why elderly animals? What inspired you to start working on this project?
Well, it was by accident, actually. I had a chance encounter with a blind old horse named Petey, and I was just completely mesmerized by Petey. And I knew I had to photograph him, so I ran into the house where Petey's guardians lived and grabbed my camera, and I spent the afternoon with him photographing him. And it wasn't until I looked at my images from that day that I began to realize why I was drawn to him. And that was because I had spent the last few years focused on helping my sister care for our aging parents. My mom had Alzheimer's disease and my dad had cancer. So we were consumed with taking care of them. And when I looked at my images of Petey, I began to realize that I was drawn to him as a way of trying to understand my grief and my fear of aging. So that inspired me to photograph other elderly animals, and I reached out to sanctuaries because there was a farm sanctuary not far from where I was living. I had not actually known about farm sanctuaries prior to working on the project, and when I discovered that there was this network of sanctuaries dedicated to rehabilitating and providing a home, forever home, to rescued farm animals, I was really drawn to visiting them and photographing the animals there. And then once I met these animals and visited these sanctuaries, met these animals, learned their stories, the project completely evolved from there. It was no longer about examining my emotional baggage or working through my emotional baggage. It was more about trying to use my images to advocate on their behalf.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I've got to say the photographs are beautiful. The book is very moving. And yes, as you say, the photos in the book were taken on farmed animal sanctuaries. For those who have never visited one, what does a day in the life of a farmed animal typically look like at a sanctuary compared to the lives of individuals who weren't so lucky to have been rescued?
That's a great question. I highly recommend that folks listening visit sanctuaries for rescued farmed animals. You experience a sense of peace at these sanctuaries like nowhere else. There is a sign at the entrance to one of the sanctuaries I visited, Posado Safe Haven Sanctuary in Sultan, Washington. And this sign really exemplifies what these sanctuaries are about. It reads, "Sweet creatures who passed this way once, scared and alone, now you are safe, now you are home. And I just cried the first time I saw it. And these sanctuaries are remarkable because nowhere else can, well, I can't say nowhere else because there are people who do adopt farmed animals. But at the sanctuaries, these animals are able to roam freely. They are able to indulge in their natural behaviors. They're allowed to grow old on mm-hmm. their own terms. Chickens spend their days outdoors basking in the sun and taking dust baths, completely different from the experience of factory farm chickens who are in densely packed conditions in poorly ventilated sheds that don't even have sunlight. Pigs can roam pastures freely and soak in wallows and sleep curled up together and are able to have social relationships. All of these experiences are denied pigs on commercial farms. So it is like night and day. And I think the people who work at sanctuaries, as I've been working on this book, one of the criticisms that I've heard sometimes from people who aren't vegans and are resistant to the idea of farm sanctuaries is that these sanctuaries only help a small percentage of the animals who are suffering on factory farms. That's beside the point. The people at these sanctuaries recognize that this is only a really small percentage of the billions of farmed animals who are suffering and dying every year. But what they are trying to show is another way of relating to these farmed animals, one that is based on empathy and respect and not based on abuse and exploitation. And the farm sanctuaries also educate the public on factory farming and the sentience of farm animals. People are able to meet these animals and see just how similar they are to the dogs and cats that we share our lives with. And hopefully people will begin to make those connections between these animals and raise questions as to why we pamper some animals and eat and exploit others. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of value to farm sanctuaries.
Absolutely, absolutely. The focus of your book is on farmed animals, but you chose to include a few photos of elderly dogs in there as well. So is that to draw the same connections?
Yes, I wanted people, when I was spending time with these animals, with the rescued farmed animals at these sanctuaries, I was surprised to see that they were like the cats and dogs that I've lived with. Prior to working on this project, I actually had never really spent time with farmed animals. So that was an eye-awakening experience for me. And I wanted to convey that through my images. When I was editing my images for the book, I was just struck by the similarities, even in the gaze that the animals are giving me between the dogs in my portraits and the farmed animals in the portraits. So I really hope that viewers of these images will see that connection and begin to question why we treat some animals as pampered pets and others we have no real protections for.
You are listening to Vancouver Co-op Radio Animal Voices here on 100.5 FM CFRO in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada.
In our society.
Mm-hmm. Well, I love one and eat the other. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And as you mentioned, these animals are all individuals with distinct personalities, and many of them are survivors of immense suffering and abuse. So how did you go about photographing them in a way that made everyone feel comfortable?
It was really important to me because these animals often were trauma survivors that I photographed them completely on their terms and not mine. I wanted to respect the fact that they are in sanctuaries and not do anything that would violate that sense of peace that they have. So I would spend a lot of time getting to know the animals. I would approach them gradually if they seemed timid. Just like with humans and with dogs and cats that we've known, farmed animals have a range of personalities. Some are really outgoing and others are pretty shy. So I would take cues from the way they responded to my presence. So sometimes I would just lie on the ground and wait for the animal to come to me, or I would lie down next to them and just spend time with them in proximity so that they could acclimate to my presence. But if an animal seemed uncomfortable with me, I would back off. I may try again at another point, but I wouldn't force it. And I would also follow them wherever they wanted to go. I didn't pose these images. So, you know, sometimes that meant photographing in really poor lighting conditions, but it was more important to me that the animals were relaxed and comfortable and that I was trying to record who they were, not record them reacting to my presence. I didn't want to be in the picture. I wanted the focus to be on them, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So clearly, the way the project evolved, these animals all had a profound effect on you. But one of your subjects in the book had a particularly influential effect. Tell us how you went from vegetarian to vegan over the course of this project.
Yeah, that's a great question. I had been a vegetarian all of my adult life, and I thought that I made humane choices for my diet. I consumed dairy, but I thought I was consuming, quote, humane dairy because they were from organic farms and no growth hormones were used. But I had, I guess, a willful ignorance about the plight or the experience that dairy cows have. I didn't think about how milk was obtained and the fact that calves were separated from their mother in order for dairy products to be created. I didn't think about what happened after a dairy cow was, quote-unquote, retired. I didn't think about male dairy calves. So it was an ethical blind spot for me. But then I started meeting dairy farm survivors and hearing their experiences, and that began to cause me to really question why it was I was still consuming dairy. So that had been kind of percolating in the back of my mind. And then I met a Holstein cow named Valentino. And he was a rescue. I met him in Orland, the Orland shelter of farm sanctuary. It no longer is in operation. They closed that location down, but I had visited there numerous times for the project. So Valentino was rescued from a nearby farm, dairy farm, and he was near death when he was accepted into the sanctuary. And he had lax tendons. He was very frail. He needed extensive physical therapy. The animal care workers at Farm Sanctuary gave him round-the-clock care. And over time, with a lot of love, he thrived. And he turned into a gentle giant. And when I met him, he was 19 years old. He was the oldest living cow that Farm Sanctuary had ever taken care of. And I spent the day with him. And when I was photographing him, I began really questioning, you know, how many Valentinos suffered and died because I liked butter in my mashed potatoes or cream in my coffee. And after I was done photographing him, he came up to me and I started petting him, and he licked me. And his tongue had that same sandpapery texture that my cat's tongues have. And when I made that final connection in my mind, at that point I knew I just could not consume dairy any longer. And I've been a vegan since then. So, yeah, it was pretty life-altering to meet Valentino. And this also exemplifies the power of these farm sanctuaries for people to meet these animals and experience them, have an intimate moment with them, will hopefully cause people to question their habits and how to make changes that are more compassionate.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious if you had any similar experiences meeting chickens with regards to the egg industry.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I have to say, even though I did consume dairy, I hadn't been eating eggs. So for me, it really was the cream and the coffee, the butter and the mashed potatoes, the mm-hmm. cheese. I had already not been eating eggs at that point. But there definitely were hens that had been rescued from horrible situations. I did meet some of the Turlock survivors. I also met some chickens who had been abandoned during Hurricane Katrina. So I was definitely mindful of the plight that chickens endure, particularly hens.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, same as the dairy animals, you know, there's so many misconceptions about, well, they lay eggs anyway, or they produce milk anyway, but they don't. And on these farms, they're not typically allowed to grow old as they are on these sanctuaries.
Right. You know, what was interesting also was that I met a horse who was a survivor of the hormone industry, actually. She was rescued from a factory farm in Canada, actually, that harvests the pregnant mare urine that's used to produce hormone replacement drugs. I was unaware of this practice prior to meeting her, but are you familiar with the PMU factory farms?
Actually, I wasn't until I read your book.
So, yeah. And it was striking just how similar the experience is to dairy as well, because the mares are repeatedly impregnated. They're confined. In a lot of respects, their experience is even more horrific because they're kept dehydrated so that their urine is more concentrated. But as with dairy cows, their babies are taken immediately from them, and the male offspring hold little value to the PMU farmers, so they're frequently slaughtered or sold at auction. So I was unaware of this practice, but I have learned that there are now man-made alternatives to the pregnant mare urine, and I hope that they become more widely used and that this barbaric practice ends.
Absolutely. Yeah, we see these across animal exploitation industries. It's all the same thing, the exploiting the reproductive system and keeping these animals confined. And when they're no longer producing a profit for the company, then that's it, right? So
Right.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things also I should say when you asked about the difference between animals who reside at sanctuaries and those that reside on commercial farms. The animals at the sanctuaries also receive individualized care. They're treated as unique individuals with unique needs. So what's been interesting is during the press for the book, I have received some rather cranky emails from people who are commercial farmers but are quote-unquote humane in their practices, and that they do provide some veterinary care for the animals. But there is a vast difference between that and really factoring in the quality of life of each animal and providing individualized care to ensure that they have a long, happy life. So there is a vast difference between sanctuaries and, you know, humane farms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like the difference between looking after somebody and looking after a machine so it'll keep running sort of deal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and your book has received a lot of critical praise around the world, but as you've mentioned, you've also gotten some pretty nasty feedback from people who have heard of your work in the news. So where does that come from? What don't people like about the images you present them with?
What I have found is that my images sometimes make people uncomfortable because it's the first time that they are considering the plight of these animals or considering the lives of these animals or recognizing the fact that these animals are sentient, that they do think and feel. And that will frequently make people uncomfortable. I guess there's the kind of cognitive dissonance that occurs where you're recognizing the underlying messages in the images, but you still want to continue consuming animal products or farming animals. So there's this need to kind of reconcile that. I mean, there's an Upton Sinclair quote that I have had in my mind over the last few weeks, which is, it is difficult to get a man, it's a little sexist, but he said man, so I'm going to say man. It is difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends upon his not understanding it. And I thought about that when I've gotten some cranky emails from farmers. And I'm still struggling, actually, quite frankly, with how to respond to that, because I don't want to be preachy. I don't think that arguing will necessarily change their hearts. My hope is that the images would do so.
Mm-hmm. That sort of speaks to the diversity of tactics in social change. There are forms of advocacy that involve speaking to people, and then there are things like art that speak to people in different ways. What role do you think that art, and particularly photography, plays in affecting social change?
Well, we are a culture that is very influenced by images. So I think that presenting positive images of farmed animals that show them as unique individuals will hopefully inspire people to think differently about them. Farmed animals themselves are frequently culturally invisible. We see them often in children's books or as caricatures. I lived for a couple of years in Texas, and I can't tell you the number of times I saw barbecue restaurants with happy-looking cartoon pigs.
Mm-hmm.
So when I say that farmed animals are culturally invisible, what I mean is depictions of them that are nuanced, that show them as individuals, that show them as sentient beings that think and feel, that's invisible. So I think that the more we can spread images that show who these animals are, the better it will be, or the more effective that will be in producing change. That's not the only way, though. People respond differently to different information. So some will respond to an image of one of my images. Others might respond to undercover images of animals suffering at these farms. Others might respond to data.
Mm-hmm.
And still others may not be able to change their habits purely for ethical reasons, but rather, oh, this veggie burger tastes good. Maybe I'll start eating more veggie burgers. So I agree with what you're saying, that a multi-pronged approach is really important.
Mm-hmm. What did you learn from publishing this book, Allowed to Grow Old, and from your experiences working on the projects?
I think that one of the things that I learned from the experience was that aging is not a curse, and in a lot of respects, it is a luxury. It is nothing short of a miracle to be in the presence of a farmed animal who has actually reached old age and defied all odds to reach old age. So I'm no longer quite as fearful about aging. I still fear dementia. My mom had it, my grandmother had it, and I don't know what the future holds for me. But being in the presence of these animals who endured so much, yet still managed to find moments of peace and joy even in their lives, that was really inspirational to me. And I hope that I will reach my old age with the same grace that they do, or that they have. So that, I think, was one of the lessons that I took from the project.
Mm-hmm. So Allowed to Grow Old is your first book of photography, and as we mentioned, it's received critical acclaim, and your photos are set to be on display in galleries across the U.S. So what's next? What's after this? Any plans for upcoming projects?
Well, I definitely want to rest a little bit. The last a couple of months have been really intense, but I definitely want to look at birth, the other end of the spectrum. So this is probably going to be logistically really hard, but I would like to try to photograph farmed animals at birth and also the early bonding that occurs between mothers and their newborns. So I would focus once again at sanctuaries. And my hope is that by showing that strong bond that occurs between the mother and her babies, I can kind of raise questions about the fact that we're denying farmed animals these fundamental relationships on industrial farms, just as old age is denied these animals, motherhood is as well. And so by trying to focus on, or by depicting these bonds between mothers and their babies, I hope that would raise some powerful questions. I also think that returning to the sanctuaries and photographing the babies once they reach their average slaughter age would be powerful as well, because I don't think people fully appreciate that these animals are just babies when they are slaughtered. So those are two of the directions that I'm thinking of moving in for my next project.
That sounds great. Yeah, looking forward to seeing more work out of you, more photographs.
Thank you so much.
How can listeners support your work? You've got a few things on your website that the book is available, but you can also order posters, I understand.
Yes, thank you for asking that. So on my website, I'm selling a poster of Bessie, who is a Holstein cow. I photographed her when she was 20 years old. I absolutely love Bessie. She had such a sass about her. You can just see it in the image that's on the poster.
Yes, you can.
If she had it's almost like she's arching her eyebrow as she's looking at me. So I am selling a poster of Bessie. I have 3 solo shows this year, and that involves a lot of printing and framing work. So I'm trying to raise funds for that. But I'm also donating 25% of the profits from the poster sales to Posadas Safe Haven, where Bessie resides, or Bessie has sadly passed, but where she had resided. And I also sell my work through fine art galleries as limited edition prints. So that is another way of supporting the work. But honestly, spreading the word about the book, posting reviews also are very helpful for especially first-time authors. If you buy a book through Amazon, post a review. Or if you're a member of Goodreads, post a review there. Or ask your library to carry the book. That's another great way to support the work. Mm-hmm. So thanks for asking.
Yeah, well, thank you, Issa, so much for your work and for joining us on Animal Voices today.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thanks so much. And I was really thrilled that there is a regular radio program dedicated to animal rights issues for, I guess, it's not just Vancouver, it's posted online, so it's everyone. Everyone can listen to it. So I love what you're doing. So thank you for having me.
Well, thank you, Issa. And if any of our listeners have been inspired by the show to visit a farm sanctuary for yourself, there are several you can visit here in Lower Mainland BC, including both Hearts on Noses Sanctuary and Saints Sanctuary in Mission, the Happy Herd Farm Sanctuary in Aldergrove, and the Sumiamu Sanctuary in South Surrey. You've been listening to our interview with photographer and writer Issa Leshko here on Animal Voices. Check out her website at issaleshko.com to view her images, purchase posters or prints, or to grab your own copy of her stunning new book, Allowed to Grow Old, Portraits of Elderly Animals at Farm Sanctuaries.
All right, we have some upcoming events for you. There's so much going on in the next week, and I hope that some of our local Vancouverites can join us. So, Worldwide Chalking Night is happening globally tonight. Elise, was it you who did an interview about chalking before?
I did, yeah, a few years ago. Yeah, it's been a while.
What's chalking, would you say?
Chalking is it's basically a form of activism where you take sidewalk chalk and write, you know, activist messages on surfaces.
And this had been invented some years ago as a thing to do worldwide when we did the interview. So now it's Worldwide Chalking Night in over 270 cities participating around the world, and Vancouver is one of them. So if you're artistically talented or creative, this is a great form of activism to take part in by drawing pictures and messages to spread the vegan and animal liberation message. So in Vancouver, this action will take place starting at 5:30 p.m. this evening, going on until 11 p.m. at the Seawall in Stanley Park. For more information, you can look on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, and we have the event posted right there.
That's fun. I would say even if you're not artistically talented, you can do chalking.
Yeah,
if you know
I
how
have.
To write. You
can, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Letters speak a lot.
Exactly.
So next week, there's a whole lineup of actions that coincide with the Australian activist duo, That Vegan Couple, who will be visiting Vancouver next week. And they are known worldwide for their being online, social media, their YouTube videos. They are activists and they are touring the world right now. And so they'll be in Vancouver next week. So if you want to meet them and attend an activism workshop that they'll be hosting, you can do that. It's all free. It's next Thursday, June the 6th, starting at 5:30 p.m. at the Creekside Community Center. Now, the vegan couple, Natasha and Luca, they're just really well known for getting people inspired, and they educate, empower, motivate vegans to be active. And I would encourage non-vegans to come to this as well, because this could be very inspiring for you.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so that is happening next Thursday. Also, Thursday evening, if you want to do something else, there's the Vegan Night Market again, which is hitting the Waldorf Hotel starting at 6 p.m., and that's been very popular in the past. They've done it several times already. So this is something I'm looking forward to, is Saturday, June the 8th from 3 to 5 p.m. There will be a day of action singing the liberation song in the city as a flash mob.
Cool.
If you want to learn more about this, because we are running out of time here, check on our Facebook page. I have posted it there as well, Animal Voices Vancouver. It'll involve another creative form of activism, which is singing as a flash mob.
Nice.
In places in Vancouver.
Cool.
On Sunday, June the 9th, this date has been declared Vancouver Animal Rights Day. And that is because we have a lot of big events happening that day. Our big biggest event of the year, you could say, is happening that day, which is the March to Close All Slaughterhouses, our annual march taking over the streets of downtown Vancouver. You know, about 400 people attended last year, and I just see it getting bigger and bigger every year. I bet there will be more there. There will be speakouts and die-ins as we take over the streets of downtown Vancouver, marching throughout. Arrive at 11 a.m. at Robson Square, and if you want more info, just search for March to Close All Slaughterhouses on Facebook for Vancouver. I'll post it on our Facebook as well. And then very quickly later on that Sunday, 3:30 p.m., there will be a large Cube of Truth event with that vegan couple again. They will be attending, and this will take place at English Bay. Come to this event, hold a TV screen, engage with passersby, or just to experience what this worldwide known animal rights outreach event is all about. So if you have any animal-related friendly events happening that you would like to have shared on Animal Voices, please send us a message at info@animalvoices.org, or you can post it on our Facebook page at Animal Voices Vancouver.
Great. Thank you, Allison. You've been listening to Animal Voices here on 100.5 FM, Vancouver Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, unceded Coast Salish territories. Join us next Friday, June 7th at noon. Next week's show will feature an interview with animal rights lawyer Rebecca Bretter on the issue of live horse export from Canada to Japan. We here at Animal Voices want to connect with you online. Visit our website, animalvoices.org, where you can stream past shows and download them as podcasts. You can also see our show blog there with detailed links, and subscribe to us on iTunes. Stay in touch with us on Facebook at Animal Voices Vancouver and on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. And now we'll leave you with some music. I still have those gorgeous Sicilian blood oranges on the brain, so this week I've selected two iconic short pieces from Prokofiev's opera, The Love for Three Oranges, which also happens to be based on an Italian play. This is a solo piano version performed by Frederick Chu. Stay tuned for Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Thank you for listening to Animal Voices today, and remember to be kind to the animals.